Welcome to our program, everybody. My name is Mary Angela DeGrazia DiTucci, and I'm a part of the Association of Gastrointestinal Motility Disorders here in Massachusetts. It is a distinct honor for us to have Dr. Kenneth Cook with us here today. He is a gastroenterologist on the faculty, the section of gastroenterology and hepatology at Wake Forest Baptist Medical Center in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Many of you probably know him. He has a career-long interest in understanding the pathophysiological mechanisms of nausea and gastroparesis, and he has quite an extensive medical background, and we're beyond grateful for him taking time out of his very busy schedule to be interviewed as we highlight Gastroparesis Awareness Month. Welcome, Dr. Cook.
Thank you very much, Mariangela. It's great to be here, and I hope I'm coming through clearly for everybody. It's a good call to get dropped or something. I'll, of course, dial back in. Thank you for the invitation. Happy to be here.
With us here today, we also have Joan Bishop from the Oley Foundation. Of course, they play an instrumental part with people with motility disorders. Joan, do you want to just introduce yourself briefly?
Oh, sure. Thank you very much, Mary Angela. I've heard from some people on the line who I'm really very interested in talking to regarding our meeting planning. And our focus is primarily on the issues and concerns of people who are on HPN, home parenteral nutrition, and tube feeding. So there's a lot of overlap, and I know gastroparesis, nausea, and everything related to motility disorders is a large part of our community. So it's so nice. I really look forward to this call. So thank you.
And thank you for coming. Excellent yes. Organization. Dr. Cook, I wonder if you could expand a little bit more on your background.
Yes. Well, I could go way back, but I'm an Iowan. I'm at the University of Iowa for my medical degree, and there were some really, really impressive gastroenterologists there. Actually, some of the founders of interest in motility, nerve and muscle coordination of the gut. Well, as a medical student, you're always going, oh, yeah, get me out of here. And anyway, I ended up going to Penn State, Hershey Medical Center, for my residency. And again, I ran into some very wonderful gastroenterologists. And so my interest just sort of somehow naturally gravitated towards the GI tract. And so I went on to do a fellowship at the University of Florida. Once again, there I was really exposed to a lot of different gastroenterologists on the faculty there. But guess what? I really gravitated towards a couple faculty interested in motility and the nerve and muscle control of the intestinal tract. And it was there I decided I would not go into private practice, but I would do academics. And I had a research lab, and they offered me a job, my first job back at Penn State. And I spent most of my career at Penn State and Hershey and developed my interest in further in the stomach and what is nausea. I had some wonderful collaborators there, and subsequently was offered a job as the chief of GI at Wake Forest, where I've now been for 18 years. So I'm an old guy. But I really still pretty intent on trying to understand more of the stomach, motility, physiology, and what is nausea continues to be a challenge. So how's that for a quick tour?
That was a really good tour. What got you interested specifically in gastroparesis? Because there's your interest between gastroparesis and nausea.
Yeah, so when I first came back to Penn State, I was interested in the small intestine and cholera toxin and the cholera problem in rabbits. How do you like that? Rabbits. There came a time in my early career where I had to make a choice because the head of psychology at Penn State was a psychophysiologist. So he understood all of the psychological components of different issues. And we got together over this issue. He began to be interested in motion sickness and nausea of motion sickness that was brought on in the laboratory. In the laboratory, he had a drum. The drum had black and white stripes in it. The drum rotated around undergraduate volunteers. And, you know, I've been in the drum. You begin to feel like you're moving, but you're not moving. You know, you're seated, but your body thinks you're moving. And that's very stressful. And if the body does not know if it's moving or not moving, that's a big problem. And people become nauseated, of all things. They become motion sick. And he was interested in this electrical rhythm of the stomach. It's like an EKG of the stomach. And as one became nauseated, that rhythm of the stomach really became chaotic, from rhythmic to chaos. From rhythmic, it went right to chaos, and this began my interest in nausea and electrical activity of the stomach. And after a while, I said, you know, I'm seeing patients who have nausea in my clinic. Their symptoms sound like my patients. I mean, their symptoms sound like the subjects in the drum who become weak and headachy, and they've got a vague abdominal discomfort, and they get nauseated. The nausea crescendos, but they say, stop the drum. Stop the drum. So nobody would vomit, but we could study nausea of different intensities. And so that's really how I got into nausea, and then nausea in motion sickness, and then all the different kinds of nausea people suffer, you know, from clinical disorders.
Wow, that's so interesting. And as you're describing it, I started to get motion sickness. Very vivid description. I think it's important that people really understand how the stomach works. A healthy stomach versus somebody with gastroparesis. Can you explain that?
Yes, thank you, because I think this has been so hard for people and doctors themselves to understand. And when I tell patients who have gastroparesis, I'm trying to help them understand. I'll say, you know, your stomach is a muscle. And they go, my stomach is a muscle? And, you know, because it's hard. Sometimes people have misconceptions of what the stomach is, and it actually is a muscle. And it's so sophisticated. That muscle initially has to relax. When we are hungry and want to eat, our stomachs are small and contracted. And then as we eat and swallow and food enters the stomach bite by bite, the stomach first has to relax to receive the food. And so most of us, you know, well, we keep eating till we're full. And that's a certain amount for me and a different amount for you. But that's what has to happen first. And of course, acid is being secreted. Pepsin is being secreted, because these are the agents that will help to dissolve those chunks of food we eat. So a normal stomach then begins also to create what we call peristaltic waves. Maybe you all have heard the word peristalsis. It's a big word, but it means simply migrating contractions. It's a contraction that is moving, and that movement over and over across the stomach creates the gentle mixing of our food. And so the other thing I tell patients is nothing empties the stomach until it's been milled by these gentle peristaltic contractions. Nothing leaves until it's milled to about 2 or 3 millimeters in diameter. So it's like the stomach doesn't want to empty food till it's like one of these suspensions, like a salad dressing that you have to shake the little particles in suspension. You know, then the stomach says, okay, this certain amount of food now in a suspension is ready to be moved into the duodenum and the small intestine then for absorption. So those peristaltic waves, not only do they mix the food, but then they empty bit by bit the mixed up food. So look at this. The stomach has to relax to receive. Then it has to mix. I'm talking about solid foods now. Maybe you have a sandwich plus a soda or something, you know. It's a mixed meal. And then it has to, fancy word is triturate. It's to mill that food. And then when the food is ready, it begins to empty it. And all of this is controlled by electrical rhythm. And that electrical rhythm is the 3-cycle per minute electrical pacemaker of the stomach. And so you can see if you have a sip of Gatorade or 3 ounces of Gatorade, stomach still has to relax to receive it. It has to, not much mixing there, is there? So it can probably gently empty that. If you had Gatorade plus a ham sandwich, oh boy, now we have to figure out, you know, the ham sandwich has to be chewed and stomach has to relax, mix. And you can see every food one ingests, the stomach has a different job to do, different work to do to get the food ready to become your nourishment. And so then that, as I said, those peristaltic waves go through another valve. Actually, you should all probably know what the pylorus is. The pylorus is the valve at the end of the stomach that opens and closes and can kind of say, wait a minute, this piece of ham is too big. This has to go back for more milling. Yet it lets smaller particles through. So, you know, your stomach is like Einstein. I mean, it's a brilliant piece of work. It's brilliantly conceived. It does sophisticated work. And in you and the healthy among us, you know, it also feels good. You know, you are rewarded for putting that food in your stomach. It feels good. And so that's how the stomach, in a nutshell, normally works. And then, you know, we can talk about gastroparesis when those different nerve and muscle functions are broken. They just don't work. And so, Angela, what do you think about that? Is that you want to have a follow-up comment on that, how it normally works?
No, I think that was perfectly stated. I mean, so many people, they're talking about their stomach, but they really, really don't know how that processes the food. So I think that was excellent. And that does then highlight what happens when a patient has gastroparesis. Now, I know a lot of patients with gastroparesis. What accompanies that sometimes is reflux. So can you explain a little bit more about, well, talk about gastroparesis and what happens and why some patients end up getting that reflux as well?
Yeah, that's a good question. And so like it's so important to know physiology to then understand pathology and pathophysiology. So this is all something we learn, and there's new information coming out regularly, incrementally, and so on. But so to take you through that, we know that many patients, those with gastroparesis, but even patients who have the same symptoms of gastroparesis but have normal emptying, we call them dyspepsia. First of all, we know in many patients the stomach simply cannot relax. That very first phase is gone. And so the stomach, instead of relaxing to receive, it's kind of tight. And patients fill up really quick. Your friend is eating a whole sandwich and you've had 3 bites and, oh, you know, I'm full. I'm even uncomfortably full. The stomach doesn't want to relax. And that bit of stretch on it can create a number of symptoms. Discomfort, doesn't feel right, you're full. That's the early satiety we talk about. And then if you go down to the next step, the peristaltic waves. They are diminished. They're not as efficient. And so the next phase of mixing is slowed, it's delayed, and people feel this prolonged fullness. But what we know now over the last 10 years is one of those key physiological properties, the rhythm is gone. And it turns out there's a special cell. All of our fellows, they come out of Wake Forest, they must know the name of the cell of the stomach that's gone, or it's not gone, it's diminished. There are fewer of them, and those are the pacemaker cells. So we now know we can identify those cells. They're the interstitial cells of Cajal. It's a big, we call them ICCs. But it turns out the more ICCs that you've lost, the more bad rhythms one has. You have less of the good 3-cycle-per-minute rhythm, and up pops bad rhythms. And some are too slow and some are too fast. And so now you have rhythm problems, and so you cannot get into those good peristaltic contractions. The food sits there. It does leave, but it's slow. And there's this nausea component. In some people, there's a pain, and now we know there's great interest in that pylorus. I mentioned the valve, that pylorus. And that pylorus, we now know in many people, is doesn't distend. There's no cancer there. There's no stricture there. It's a muscle coordination problem. And so we can talk about diagnosis later, but you see these, so there are many parts that can go wrong as you develop gastroparesis, and some may have one or two or all of those things going on. And then to make matters worse, you know, as the stomach backs up, and perhaps as you lay down or bend over, or a certain kind of gastroparesis has more obstructive components than others, guess what? It may be easier for the food and the acid to come up into the esophagus. That may be the lesser route of resistance than going out through the pylorus. And so it turns out, Angela, it's probably about, I bet 90% of my patients are on something to suppress acid. And some are very hard to control, and we look for a certain kind of gastroparesis I can talk about later. But this is a big deal. And even some of my patients, I would even call them GERD predominant gastroparesis. They have actually almost more GERD symptoms than the typical symptoms of nausea, early satiety, fullness that we associate with gastroparesis. So that GERD ties in very closely gastroparesis. And because you also have the gastroparesis, I believe it can be much more difficult to control that kind of GERD.
I see. So how do you go about ruling out other diagnoses?
Well, that's a key question, because the symptoms, we used to say this, if your listeners are, this is how important words are. We used to say symptoms of gastroparesis. It really sounds like gastroparesis possesses those symptoms, doesn't it?
Yes.
It sounds like those symptoms are possessed by gastroparesis. I prefer symptoms associated with gastroparesis, because those same symptoms can be caused by other organs. And so when I see somebody with gastroparesis and I think those symptoms are probably due to your gastroparesis, but I see your gallbladder still there. You still have your gallbladder. So you know, when gallbladder doesn't work, it often creates nausea, discomfort, can even be in the middle of the abdomen, not to the right side. And, you know, it's worse after eating. And after, you know, a half hour, hour starts to feel better. And you say, oh my gosh, that's my stomach acting up again. But no, maybe it's your gallbladder. Another one that you have to be aware of, I think, that is common and get people with gastroparesis, they also have small bowel motility problem, unfortunately, and then they get small bowel bacterial overgrowth. So they eat, and as the food begins to empty the stomach, albeit slowly, bacteria in the small bowel begin to enjoy it, and they're making gases, and there's some malabsorption, and before long, you know, folks are very ill, but they actually have two problems, and you perhaps should be addressing the small bowel bacterial overgrowth. And then finally, irritable bowel, very common in people with gastroparesis. And, you know, once again, after you eat, the colon is supposed to come to life and do some contracting itself, and it can create bloating and discomfort. And before long, it's very confusing exactly what symptoms are, you know, being driven by what disease. And to make matters, as some of our listeners may know, they've been diagnosed with all of these things. They have GERD, gastroparesis, small bowel bacterial overgrowth, and irritable bowel. And so, I call it divide and conquer. You have to divide up those symptoms, that is, divide them up amongst what disorders, diseases, you know, does the patient have? They may have all of those. And if I forgot gallbladder, add gallbladder. So this is why these are symptoms associated with gastroparesis, but I always look for other possibilities.
I like that. That's a very good way of putting it. Now, you kind of hinted at this, so I'm just going to make a little probe. Are there different types of gastroparesis?
Yeah, you know, right now you have any delay in gastric emptying. You know, also I should make a mention here that it's been 20 years, but we still think the gold standard test is the egg beater's sandwich. The Nuclear Medicine Society and the Motility Society has agreed this is the most standardized test. And so I still see now and then people getting an oatmeal test, or I don't know, just have to be sure it's the right test. It's the most standardized test to be sure that you do have at least the right test to at least say you have delayed emptying. Now, let's say you have delayed emptying. You know, it can be mild. That might not even explain your symptoms, up to moderate or severe. And, you know, you may know that we determine that by how much of the meal remains in the stomach at 4 hours. With this particular meal, almost everybody, healthy people, will have less than 10% left after 4 hours of work, less than 10% in the stomach. So we, based on, you know, you've got 15%, you've got 20%, you have 60% retained, we call you gastroparesis. But, you know, we find that in people who have diabetes, type 1 or type 2. We find this in people who have had idiopathic. We don't know why you have it. We just don't know. There's no clues. Maybe you had food poisoning. Maybe you had a virus. Just don't know. That's idiopathic. That's almost two-thirds of our patients. And then there's a tiny group, you know, with rarer diseases that will get gastroparesis. But, you know, it goes further than that, because we're beginning to look at people who have gastroparesis and normal electrical rhythm, people who have gastroparesis and dysrhythmias. That's another cut point. Why would you have gastroparesis but a perfect pacemaker? And that whole story is some of the research I've been doing at Wake Forest and Penn State, that there are patients who have pyloric problems primarily. They are primarily a pylorus problem. And there we can treat differently. There, if it's a pylorus that's too tight or in spasm, we can stretch it with a balloon. We can put Botox in there. This pylorus is becoming very interesting from a therapeutic standpoint, because that's more focused. You know, it's more focused part of the pathophysiology. Otherwise, over the past 20 years, we've just been trying to make the stomach work harder. You know, we use these so-called prokinetic agent, which just means, you know, go faster, work harder, and we try to get more contractions. But they really haven't worked very well over the years. And so this is why ideas are changing now about the rhythm. How do we get the rhythm back? What do we do about the pylorus? And so this is where there we call them subtypes of gastroparesis. And hopefully there's a little more sophistication in the diagnosis. You can be a little more precise about where you want to take that therapy.
Wow, that's an excellent explanation. Yeah, excellent. There's another point that I know when patients go to the doctor and they say they have pain, and we talked about this a little bit beforehand, but some patients really have difficulty describing their symptoms. How do you facilitate that conversation?
Yeah, two ways. You know, one, folks, as they, you know, they are suffering from their different postprandial symptoms, and they might tell me about three or four symptoms. You know, I've got the heartburn, I've got this pain, a discomfort, I have nausea, then I vomit. And I'll say, wait, you know, let's just ask this question. What symptom bothers you the most? And I say, I just want to hear one. In a simple mind, I just want, which one is the worst? And sometimes I'll say, okay, I'll take two. But you see, if a patient says, well, my gosh, my number one symptom is pain, then I need to go focus on that pain, because that pain may not be the stomach. That pain may be coming from their gallbladder. That pain may be coming from a scar on their abdomen from their previous cholecystectomy. Maybe that pain is actually an irritable bowel pain. But you see, just that my number one problem is the pain makes me think about that pain, the pattern of pain, and have we done everything we need to do to actually discover the source of the pain? Because, you know, if I can have the surgeon remove the gallbladder, and everybody thought it was the stomach, now the gallbladder was the problem, the pain is gone, maybe a lot of the other symptoms will go away as well. And if not, you know, you investigate those. So I think it's important for the patients to help the doc maybe say, yeah, there's a whole lot of things going on, but I don't want to tell you, this one's bothering the most. The second thing is a hard one is nausea. Nausea is very hard to describe. And I have struggled with this one. Hard for patients, or sometimes you just feel sick, everything from, you know, fatigue and nausea. You try to describe nausea without using the word nausea. It's hard. About to vomit, sick to my stomach, but we developed a little nausea locator diagram, and I was pretty shocked actually to learn that about 25% of my patients, when I said, where's your nausea, locate it for me. I have a little map of the body, and they would circle right in the middle of the chest. I'd say, your nausea is there? Your nausea is in your chest? And they say, yep. And you know, it turns out that we talked about GERD. Well, sometimes when acid comes up into the esophagus, it doesn't burn so much as create pressure in other people. It can create hoarseness in other people. In my experience, it creates a sense of nausea. Well, that's important to know because maybe that GERD has not been aggressively treated, really aggressively treated. Maybe you can get rid of some of that nausea that's related to more acid reflux. So any case, people, I do believe you can locate nausea better. Some people, they point in the lower abdomen, way beyond where your actual stomach is, way lower. And we've helped that nausea by helping irritable bowel, for instance. So nausea is also a nonspecific. It's not associated. Well, it is associated with gastroparesis, but it's not, you know, there's a lot of things that can cause nausea. That's a whole nother, you know, symptom that kind of needs to be delved into, of course.
I get this question a lot asked to me, and a lot of patients want to know, does gastroparesis progress?
Yeah, in my experience, I would have to say rarely. I have a number of patients who actually get better. I think, and through our NIH consortium, I'm part of our NIH gastroparesis consortium that is in its 15th year. I should give a shout out to our NIH and our government. They have funded research for this area. And we have it's being reviewed by a journal. But it's been published in abstract, so I can mention it. But I think it'll be pretty much an eye opener for a lot of folks, a lot of doctors. And that is, we saw patients got a gastric emptying study on week one when they enrolled, and they got a gastric emptying study 48 weeks later. Let's say 1 year later, everybody got another gastric emptying study. And you know that about 40% of people no longer had gastroparesis. And so by that test, that delay may come and go. And so I don't think people should think they're necessarily stuck with the diagnosis forever. The problem was that many of these patients still had their symptoms. And that's why I think you should know there's new ideas that these symptoms of nausea and early satiety, they may be more subtle. They really are due to inability to relax the stomach. Or maybe we need to get your rhythm better. And you'd feel better from those aspects, not just the rate of emptying. So I think in the next couple of years, we're going to see some more ideas about treatment and the pathophysiology of those symptoms. I think some people definitely go down, you know, get more severe, but I think it's a smaller number than may actually get better. And a big bunch of folks, of course, kind of don't change. So it's a heterogeneous population, for sure.
And what about, and this is such an instrumental part of treating patients with gastroparesis, but what about the dietary needs?
Yeah, I still spend most of my time with patients talking about their diets because we have so few drugs, unfortunately. I think there's pharmaceutical folks are interested in this area because we have so much unmet need. But because of the complexity of the nerve and muscle, and remember the ICCs, I would be quizzing you about now and say, what the ICC stands for and what does it do? So those pacemaker cells, all these things are parts of the puzzle and make it hard for pharmaceuticals to know exactly where to go. But that being said, the diet is crucial. So if your stomach has a muscle, like a disability, there's a muscle problem. It's not your leg, it's your stomach. You need to know that, and then you need to adjust your diet to the level of muscle activity that you have. And that includes the relaxation part. That includes, you know, how full you feel. We actually do like a water load test. You drink water over 5 minutes till you're completely full. And healthy people drink about 20 ounces in 5 minutes. And they say, I'm full. And that's it. They're full. My patients try this, and they drink about 8 ounces. And not only are they full, they're nauseated. They have discomfort. And that tells me that stomach doesn't stretch. You know, they know that, but this is an objective way to say, okay, look, you know, your stomach doesn't stretch. You're limited to 3 or 4 ounces at a setting. You may drink 3 or 4 ounces of a nutrient drink. I say, do not tell me about water. Do not tell me, please do not tell me you're drinking water. And they say, why? What's wrong? And then I say stuff like, is outrageous stuff like, well, I hate water. They say, you hate water? I said, yeah, I hate water. And I say, well, why do you hate water? Well, I say, well, in your case, I hate water because you're not getting any nutrition. You're not getting any electrolytes. And so water is not a good choice for your stomach and your problem. That's why my patients are all on electrolyte solutions to try to keep them hydrated. And then the foods has been like a three-step diet that most of, I'm sure who's listening knows, that we advance from electrolyte type fluids to soups and smoothies, usually not dairy-based if it has problems with dairy. Because liquid nutrition, you could imagine, would take less muscle power to empty than a solid. And that's why the soups and smoothies are there. And then the third step, I say, well, you got that down. You're tolerating that. Maybe you're maintaining your weight or at least adding a little bit. And they say, what about solid food? And I say, whoa, solid food. Now, that's a challenge for the stomach. If you had a bad leg, the challenge might be going up 6 flights of stairs. That's going to be hard on that leg. Well, solid foods are going to be more work. And so I start with starches and, like, you know, potatoes, mashed potatoes. How difficult would that be? And you see, you start to build that idea that, yeah, mashed potatoes, rice, crackers, there. Turns out that the stomach, this is all known. The physiology is starches are much easier to mix and empty than protein. And protein is easier to mix and empty than fat. Fat really slows the stomach down. And then the slowest thing would be fresh, you know, raw vegetables, like a fresh carrot, a fresh piece of a cucumber. Imagine the weak stomach trying to mix that and then empty that. That's the last thing that all of us, that healthy stomachs can empty. So there's a whole variety of foods that we try to coach people on what their stomachs can handle so that they can comfortably nourish themselves. Comfortably nourish themselves despite their stomach being, you know, have these neuromuscular problems. So, yeah, that's me. Patients that keeps them out of the emergency room, you know, for recurrent dehydration. May keep them off the enteral feeding. We talk about, you know, when we can't do that, when we can't nourish, person can't nourish themselves because their stomachs are that, you know, dysfunctional. Then we have to turn to the enteral feeding and even the TPN because the stomach is that dysfunctional. Nerve muscles don't work and you don't empty enough to be able to nourish yourself. So we have to bypass the stomach with these other feeding modalities.
Yeah, we have we have Melissa Adams Van Houten on the program, and she's the public policy and outreach director for our organization, and she also has I've lost count how many Facebook groups for the gastroparesis community. It seems like she's always adding them. So, Melissa, you have a few questions that you wanted to pose, if that's okay.
I do have, and thank you. And yes, I have lost count of how many groups there are, but there are many. And yeah. One of the things that they really wanted me to ask you was about the SMART pill versus the gastric emptying study for diagnosis. And I guess my follow-up question with that would be, first of all, you know, which one is more accurate or preferred for diagnosing gastroparesis? But also, when using the gastric emptying study, can it give you information other than just the emptying rate? Does it tell you anything else?
All right, great question. So these are two diagnostic tests. The gastric emptying I mentioned has an isotope in it, so there's some radiation exposure. And over the years, it is primarily, it's just for emptying. There are, and it's emptying over 4 hours, I mentioned. And so you kind of get that rate over time. Now, we are working on different ways to make it smarter, you know, look at more of the fundus relaxation. You can even do some high-powered computerized things to look for peristaltic waves. But that's kind of the simple gold standard. The SMART pill, in contrast, you know, is this, it's a bit of a horse pill. It's a bit of a pill to swallow, but it measures pH and pressure and temperature, and you eat it with a more of a granola-like meal. Has the same calories as the egg beater sandwich, but it tells you kind of a different story. It tells you how many hours that capsule is in the stomach. So we know that healthy people will empty it in 5 hours or less. So here you get one number, you know, like your stomach took, 8 hours to empty it. So it's too slow. But, you know, it also keeps going. And so next it will tell you about small bowel transit time. And we know what normals are. And so we can see if your small bowel is slow. And then it actually goes on and you can read the colon transit time. So I like this test a lot when I have people that I might want to know it with one test about all of the stomach, the small bowel, and the colon. And so they're quite different then in that respect. And the recording goes on for 5 to 7 days. So you wear a little harness and get that information. And then it's downloaded when you take that back to the doc. So the gastric emptying tells you gastric emptying only, but it's been around solid, good test for a long time. The SMART pill will give you information on the other small bowel and colon as well, and that might be of interest to you or your doctor, those additional organs that may be dysfunctional. Does that answer your question?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you. I appreciate it. The other area I wanted to bring up, and this is quite a switch in subjects, but a lot of talk has been going on about the brain-gut axis. And can you help us understand that and tell us what you think about the focus on that in terms of gastroparesis?
Yeah. So the brain-gut axis, you might imagine, brings into play, of course, two incredible different organizations. I mean, the brain, that's just a little complex. And then the gut, are you kidding? I just talked about how complex that is. And so those interested in that brain-gut axis try to figure out how the two organs influence each other. And it gets really tricky after that. So let me give you my perspective, because over the years, I've been more focused on, let's say, the gut part. And my belief is if your stomach doesn't work, or you have nausea all the time, or you have heartburn all the time, number one, you have those symptoms because there's a problem in the esophagus or the stomach or the colon. The problem is in the periphery. And that problem is a message that your brain gets. That's called a symptom, right? If that message of a problem, let's say in the stomach, a bad rhythm, a poor relaxation, food hanging around, that message that gets through the neurons, through the vagus nerve, reaches your consciousness, we call it a symptom. And so I've always focused on, let's fix what's in the periphery. And I believe if we fixed what's in the periphery gone bad, you'd feel better. And some symptoms are very depressing. Nausea is an incredibly debilitating, depressing symptom. And so I focus less on the depression, and where others might, you know, well, let's start an antidepressant, I'd probably go with, well, let's fix the stomach. Do you see? So there's a real brain gut, you know, it goes back and forth. And so this is where, your attitude towards your symptom, your support system that helps you with your symptom, maybe it's your spouse, your family, your own makeup is a hugely complicated psychosocial brain issue that has to deal with these diseases. And I think these diseases sometimes, you know, it takes a subtle diagnosis. They're sometimes written off as not important, not real. We see people with normal gastric emptying who have all these same symptoms, but they have normal gastric emptying. But guess what? We're finding dysrhythmias in these people. We're finding they can't drink much water either. Guess what? They have problems of gastric relaxation and rhythm. But it's not so bad that they have gastroparesis. So there's the thought there's really a range of these problems, and they're very bad symptoms. We're after 12 years, I'm putting together a bit of a cookbook, and it won't be spelled K-O-C-H, by the way, like the Germans cook. It won't be a cookbook. But one of the things that took me about a few decades to appreciate was patients would continually say, you know, I just want my life back. And I go, yeah, okay, sure. Who doesn't want their life back? I wish I had my life back. But I want my life back. And it took me forever to figure out what they meant was the very simple thing. All they wanted back, really, was the ability to sit with their family and their friends and have a simple meal together.
Yes.
They lost that. And that, I think you lose that, you lose a lot. And most folks, I suspect, except the patients, don't get it. So you lose a lot. And you don't have to have gastroparesis to have that kind of symptom. So it gets complex about the brain interaction. But as I said, I work really hard to work on the periphery. By the way, if it was a chest pain problem, I mean, a lot of chest pain issues, I don't think they talk so much about the brain-heart interaction. Maybe it's not as complex. You just fix the heart, you'll feel better. Not quite that simple. But anyway, I've digressed a bit, but let me just say that brain gut thing you'll keep reading about, and there are physicians, doctors who are researching more the brain part and perhaps more the gut part, and some people are bringing them together, but all of it is probably relevant, and it you'll see the different focuses and different research come out on both these areas.
Thank you. And I don't have any further questions, but I do want to say that as a patient, I really, really appreciate that thoughtful response and that approach. Thank you.
Does anybody have a question they would like to ask?
Hi. This is Dr. George Carbone from here, Simi Valley, California. I have a son with a severe gastroparesis secondary to a myopathic form due to MYH11 defect. And my question is, he has a very distended stomach. He's on TPN and the J2 feedings. However, but what suppresses the hunger mechanism? And the reason I ask that is because he's constantly hungry, he gets so angry and that he can't eat. And yet when he eats anything or drinks anything, he'll just throw it up. So we've gone crazy trying to suppress the hunger mechanism because it hasn't stopped, even though he's on TPN and J2 feedings. Any answer to that?
Yeah, that's very interesting. How old is your son?
My son's 33 years old. He's had, SIPO for the last, 20 years, but we just recently, one of the rare cases that they've diagnosed genetically is the MYH11 defect from chromosome 16.
Yeah, so, they say myopathy because they have biopsied, like they actually know.
Physiologic testing, not a biopsy, but we actually have the genetic defect that what he has. It was actually exome analysis.
Well, there is some, as you know, there are different kinds of pseudo-obstruction that are very sophisticated. They've been classified and it needn't be just those interstitial cells, those pacemaker cells I mentioned. In the case you're mentioning, the smooth muscle, the actual muscle is defective, and so it doesn't contract well or at all. And you may even have a good pacemaker, a rhythm, but the muscle doesn't work. By the way, that's almost like electromechanical dissociation, and I've always hypothesized it's out there. I don't know that I've seen very many cases of that. So here's the question. Here's the thing. Your son would really like to eat. He gets really hungry, but it goes down, and then he gets sick right away. Is that kind of it?
Yes. Yes.
And he's had he's had the 4-hour gastric emptying studies.
Oh yeah, very delayed.
Yeah. So that's a very unusual thing. I have so many patients that I've seen with gastroparesis, and 99% of them say, I don't get hungry. I don't get hungry. And I just don't feel like eating. I'm not hungry. I eat by the clock because I need to. I nibble along like I was telling you folks. That's what most do. So when I see a patient that comes to me that says, I'm hungry, I almost say, are we sure this is gastroparesis? Because in my experience, I don't hear about hunger. And so that's a disconnect for me. And I'll say, you need to have the gastric emptying done here, awake, where I know how it's done. I know the people. Was it done wrong? There's something wrong. And so your son's case is very, very unusual in my experience. And that's why I always go back. I question, as I'm sure you have over the years, question the diagnosis. What do we have here? So is your son able to work? What does your son do?
No, he's on disability because of the severe. He has severe gastroparesis. No two ways about that. I mean, we've had, since he was a kid, we've had physiologic tests done where they, stick the tube down, as well as, like I said, we just got the genetic diagnosis, I have a family history of that, so it's been written up, and it's been written up, actually, an article is written up by Dr. Malunsky concerning our particular case, because there's been actin cases that have been diagnosed, and this is the first case with heavy chain myosin as a defect.
Yeah. Well, the hunger part is, it gets to, what makes us hungry, and, that isn't even well studied. I always thought, hunger is when our stomachs are empty. The stomach is empty, and it's contracted, and it's tight. And so we say, well, I'm on empty, I'm hungry, feed me something. That stomach starts to relax and feel better because it's filling up and it's relaxing. You know, the test you might look for is the electrogastrogram with a water load. You know, what rhythm is his stomach in? How much can he drink? Is this a big floppy stomach or a little tight stomach?
Yes, that's basically what he has, a large floppy stomach, yes.
Yeah, an enlarged floppy stomach. Is that right? Even by endoscopy or by
yes,
by
yes.
Image. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So then I think you have to maybe look into hunger. Yeah. Is this the definition of hunger for him? Is he wants to eat? Now, I wouldn't know how to turn that off, except you know, but that's what really really bothers him. Hungry all the time. He's hungry all the time?
Yes, he's hungry all the time, yeah.
Yeah. I don't even know where to go with that. That's a very unusual.
Yeah.
And other than, and if his stomach's already relaxed, I don't know how you can relax it further. So, yeah, fascinating. But wish I had a way to turn it off other than, you know, olive oil.
Yeah, thank you.
Something oily, but that's very, very rare. I'm sorry.
Okay, thank you.
Anyone else have a question they would like to pose to Dr. Cook? Wait. I hear somebody whispering. Yes, go ahead.
I was just curious if there was any studies done for any treatments of people who have gastroparesis from a lot of surgeries.
Can you say your name?
Adhesion. I'm sorry, my name is Heather.
What is it?
Heather.
Okay. I'm sorry.
I'm just looking for some type of insight. What I'm finding is everything is once it's determined that it's because of obstructions exist, that there's really not a lot of options. I'm just wondering if there's any studies towards that or anything like that in that direction.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah. Is the question about gastroparesis after various surgeries.
Correct. That's exacerbated from abdominal adhesions.
Okay, plus the adhesion thing. Okay, mm-hmm. So yes, you know, anytime you touch the stomach, unfortunately, with a surgery, there's the possibility of a bad event. And, you know, fundoplication, you know, for GERD is the most common surgery now. That mm-hmm. results in gastroparesis.
Yeah, I've had three that have failed, and so there's no really options now. And it's kind of just, you know, there's the CTA to check the blood flow, but that's about the extent of it. It's a little frustrating. So I was just curious if there's any studies down that route. I know that there's crossovers with pseudo-obstructions and things like that, but once they determine that it's likely because of scar tissue or adhesions, then that's the determined the cause, and then we just work with the symptoms only. And as you know, those symptoms treatments are limited.
Yeah, so are you talking specifically after fundoplication or a failed fundoplication?
Yes.
Yeah, that's the most common. I mean, of course, like for like an ulcer operation where you have to remove the half of the stomach, the distal half, then you lose the part of the stomach that can really create peristaltic waves. People with have some kind of esophageal cancers, you have to remove the top half of the stomach and pull the stomach up, and their stomachs never work right after that. So number one, all these different surgeries themselves cause some problem. Now, in terms of post fundoplication, yeah, we see this a lot. And so there's two things. One, they may have inadvertently done a vagotomy. And if the vagus got cut, you really have to be concerned about the pylorus. Because the pylorus without the vagus, you know, presence can be in spasm. And here again, we will look at the stomach's electrical rhythm, the water load, because just the delay itself is not enough. Then we may even want to do what's called an endoflip study, where you can put a balloon in the pylorus and measure how distensible it is. So I never blame things on adhesion. And I tend not to talk about adhesions unless I can prove they're there with an, you know, like absolutely obstructing something. Because
they were noted in the recurring Nissens. There was 3 Nissens that had failed, and in each of those Nissens, they were talking about how more and more adhesions were removed. So my question is there really any studies? I mean, I understand that there's a physical blockage that's contributing to like the cells, you know. Basically, my guidance has been protect the cells and keep things moving. And so they do dilations of the esophagus and the pylorus to try to help move things through. But that's also the small dysmotility in the small intestines as well. So what we're finding is we're trying to sign up for studies and things like this to try to get some type of relief, but I'm being disqualified because of the surgical history. So I was just curious if there was any study along that route in the future or anything like that that could help people in this position, like myself, where I really have no options.
Yeah, no, you're right about that. There's to my knowledge right now, there are no like studies just with postfundal placation patients like you who've had one or two. And the stomach's not working. Either it wasn't working before the fundal placation, or it's not working now. But you're right. The drug companies look for very specific populations. Even those are heterogeneous, and they tend not to include people who've had various surgical procedures. And you just have to, unfortunately, get drugs approved on these very quote unquote clean populations. As soon as we have them, we would try them on folks who've had post-surgical issues of all kinds. But it's a limited population. There's many of you out there, but it's still different than what the big drug companies focus on to get a new drug approved. Yeah, it's a tough spot.
Yeah, it is. Okay, thank you for your time. I appreciate it. It's been very helpful. Thank you.
You are such an incredible educator and physician, and we cannot thank you enough for sharing all your time and expertise and your compassion. You really understand the patient. The motto of our organization is we serve as a beacon of hope and help to those in need, and certainly you epitomize those words. And I think the information that you provide and the way that you educate the patients empowers them to be able to endure what they're enduring and to share that torch of learning with other people so they'll understand. Thank you so much again. And thank you all for coming to our program. God bless you all. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Thank you. Bye-bye.